Today, the nature of thought is something lab scientists study. But a century or so ago, philosophers had the monopoly on explaining human thought. Among the most provocative and influential was Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher who famously declared that God is dead. In some ways, Nietzsche seems like a profoundly un-American philosopher. He picked holes in a lot of this country's sacred values. But historian Jennifer Ratner Rosenhagen says he also had a huge influence here. In her book American Nietzsche, A History of an Icon and His Ideas, she writes that in the late 1800s, Nietzsche was just starting to make a name for himself in Europe when he went insane. And that fascinated American commentators. Was Nietzsche a genius, a madman, or a mad genius? Steve Paulson asked Ratner Rosenhagen whether the early American fascination with Nietzsche was with the person or his ideas.
I would say that it's both the ideas and it's the person. So what about the ideas? Very simply, Nietzsche wrote a lot. He packed a lot in his productive lifetime. But if we can say that there's a general arc to his writings, Nietzsche committed himself from the beginning to the end to testing out the universality of our truth.
And he questioned everything.
He
questioned all received wisdom in a way. He questioned the moral system. He questioned whether there were any such things as eternal truth. He questioned God. I mean, famously said, God is dead.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can see, I suppose, by people who felt shackled mm-hmm. by those old morals, those virtues that have been passed down generation after generation, it must have been seen as very liberating.
Certainly. So the ideas themselves was that Nietzsche hit people, both their religion as well as their philosophical systems, in the heart, both with his aphorisms as well as with his extended essays. Nietzsche committed himself to unpacking everything that we consider true, our belief in God, our religious convictions, our belief in democracy and human equality. All of these are human, all too human constructions. They are not mirrors of reality. They are not products of divine intervention. They're human products. They're human constructions. And so Nietzsche, essentially, he likened himself to a philosopher with a hammer, and by that he meant a hammer with a tuning fork to sound out the hollow idols of our ideals. And so if we can say what brings together this enormously diverse group or groups of 20th century readers is Nietzsche's reckoning with universal truth, whether it's religious truth or philosophical truth or political truth, this is what brings all readers in conversation with Nietzsche.
Now, the story gets more curious as well. And part of your larger message, your larger argument in your book is that Nietzsche was interpreted in many different ways mm-hmm. by people with all kinds of conflicting views. And there were Christians, for instance, who leapt into the discussion and said, actually, for all of his critical comments about Christianity, there's something here that is compatible with Christianity. Who were some of those people?
Well, this was, for me, an early surprising discovery. I figured I'd find some atheists or at least some Christians eager to find a voice and find a language for getting rid of their piety. I wasn't quite accounting for the fact of how many deeply pious Christian commentators would find something useful in Nietzsche. Something that I talk about in the book is, in fact, one of the most important points of entry for Nietzsche's philosophy in the early 20th century were clergy members, Christian clergy, Christian theologian, who looked to Nietzsche and said, here's someone who's criticizing our Christianity as something outworn, as something unfit for modernity. And you know what? Maybe he's right. Hmm. So they take Nietzsche, and of course they don't like all the zingers he has to say, but they recognize in Nietzsche a valuable foe. That Nietzsche has pointed out that perhaps our pews are filled with Christians who are praying to a God that they really don't believe in anymore. And if that's the case, what does our Christianity mean to us in modernity? It's not just enough to get the pews filled. We need worthy Christians. These readers are reading Nietzsche at a time when there's a lot of concern, especially among mainline liberal Protestants in the United States, that Christianity had become feminized, that it had become too, and this is the term that's used, they wanted a muscular Christianity. The concern among liberal Protestants is that in their effort to accommodate modernity, to accommodate changes in American social and political and economic life, in an effort to accommodate modern sciences, in an effort to accommodate Darwin, maybe they had gone too far. And they had turned their religion simply into a kind of feel-good ethics rather than a deep source of belief and a deep transcendent source of meaning. And so they found in Nietzsche, when Nietzsche hit, it hurt. Hmm. But they said it hurt in a useful way. In other words, it was time to take Nietzsche at his word and see if the Christianity that they were offering was in fact robust enough to face the modern course.
Now, one of Nietzsche's most famous ideas was the Übermensch, the Superman. A lot of people have gravitated to this idea. Some people have been horrified by it. How did Americans respond to Nietzsche's call that we need to throw out all authority and we need the new Superman?
As you can imagine, this was one of the most popular Nietzschean ideas on this side of the Atlantic. So Nietzsche writes about the Übermensch in Thus Spoke Zarathustra of 1883. But he doesn't give his readers a lot to go on. When he writes about the Übermensch, it's written, this figure of the future is written really in very poetic, very sketchy terms. And so that leaves a heck of a lot of interpretive wiggle room on this side of the Atlantic. What is clear is that he is calling for some sort of figure of the future that will be an improvement on human beings as we are. What exactly that means, that becomes the vibrant field of interpretive contestation as soon as the term hits American shores.
But again, the suggestion was that sort of received wisdom from the masses was not worthwhile. So you needed these extraordinary people to step in and to kind of create their own moral system, right?
Sure. The first way that the Übermensch as a figure gets put to work is actually a little bit more down to earth even than that. And that is the Übermensch comes into American discourse at a time, you know, turn of the last century, when American commentators all across the political spectrum are worried about the atomistic tendencies of industrial capitalism and the leveling tendencies of a mass democracy. So they're worried about individualism and individuality and what that might look like in the 20th century. And here you have a term, the Superman, the Beyond Man, the Overman. And these, of course, are all the various translations that get put out there. And there's incredible contestation over what to actually call this thing. What was clear is this quest for an improved human being, precisely at a time that American observers are worried that Americans as individuals are becoming worse off in modernity.
Now, the story then gets more complicated because back in Europe, in Germany, the Nazis seized upon Nietzsche as well. He became a hero. And there's been, of course, great controversy to this day whether Nietzsche's ideas actually were in support of Nazi ideology. But, I mean, the idea of throwing out the old moral system and, you know, bringing in this new super race, mm-hmm. that didn't go over very well in the United States. Obviously, Germany became our enemy.
No, of course. It did not go over very well at all. But it folded somewhat easily into a conversation that was already here. In other words, there were all sorts of Übermenschen alive and well in the 1900s. So you could have Jack London endorsing a socialist Übermensch who was going to overthrow capitalism. You had Margaret Sanger, yet another person discovering the Überfrau, who takes Nietzsche's Death of All Gods and turns it into a slogan for her own campaign for the birth control, that women should bow to, quote, no gods and no masters. So talk about self-sovereignty. She wanted the self-sovereignty of the body. So there's all these uses of Nietzsche overcoming what? What did he mean? Overcoming capitalism, overcoming men, overcoming this, overcoming that. Well, when war breaks out in Europe in 1914, it uncomfortably fits in, even with those who are endorsing the Übermensch, that the kind of overcoming that the Übermensch engages in is overcoming either society or overcoming others. And so it's not hard then for Americans to then understand how that then becomes overcoming, oh, neutral Belgium. And so, of course, people respond with alarm. And Nietzsche is credited almost instantaneously as the first cause of the First World War. In fact, a popular phrase was the Euro-Nietzschean War. You know, Germans love their philosophy. Nietzsche was the philosophical expression of blood and iron. And we're seeing it now in the grotesque scenes from Europe.
How could this one man be interpreted in so many different ways?
Because he spoke in many registers, because he wrote very powerfully, because he gave different language, different voice for people articulating, struggling with some sort of inherited truth. What I think, though, is interesting is not just the sheer variety. In other words, I think that would be a curiosity, but I don't think that would tell us much about American life if we just let sheer variety have the last word. So I think what's interesting is the curious similarities in what at first blush look like very different readings. And when we listen for that, we actually hear some clear through lines in this interpretation. In other words, variety is only part of the story, but rather curious harmonies. So, for example, you can take thinkers left and right, put them side by side, and you start to hear a similar Nietzsche. And one of those is, as I said, that Nietzsche pushing at this notion of universal truth. And while this wasn't a welcome idea for many Americans, it was, for many Americans of the 20th century, an unavoidable intellectual problem that they had to confront. And this is not anything new for America of the 20th century, but it seemed particularly pressing in a pluralist society of many religions, of many different languages, of many different ethnic and racial groups. Here was a thinker who said there is no universal truth. And so Americans, Nietzsche helped Americans to wrestle with our own pluralism, our own pluralist nationhood. And that's something you can hear through all of these very different receptions.
One final question. Is Friedrich Nietzsche still dangerous today? And I don't mean in the sense of inspiring deranged people to go out and shoot someone. But I mean,
I'm afraid in that sense, probably still.
But his ideas, I mean, his challenge to authority, to the idea that there are no eternal truths, is this still a dangerous idea?
Yes and no. I mean, now Nietzsche's iconoclasm is so utterly conventional. I mean, so that we have it on our coffee cups. We have people with tattoos, you know, Nietzsche tattoos on their forearms and bellies. So can an idea like that have the same sort of power it had when readers first encountered it over 100 years ago? I'm not sure. But I think Nietzsche, it will have that power every time readers actually get their hands on his texts. I'm not sure that will go away.
Jennifer Ratner Rosenhagen is the author of American Nietzsche, A History of an Icon and His Ideas. She spoke with Steve Paulson.